Hi, everyone, and welcome to Notorious Women Podcast, a comedy podcast about some of history's most notorious women. Today, we have with us a very special guest. We are so excited to welcome Fizza Dasani to our studios. Okay, she is an actress. She is a stand-up. She is a writer. She's a podcast host herself. And she's one of the funniest people we know. Welcome to our show, Fizza. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Miriam. Thank you, Lavetta. What an intro.
Thank you very much. I worked really hard on it.
You killed it.
Thank you. I really appreciate your support. How are you?
So welcome. Yes, how are you? How are you on this rainy LA day?
Oh, I'm good, except I have two loaded huskies. Normally, we run it out in the morning, and we didn't have that opportunity. So, a lot of energy, and only one out of two of them pooped. So, we're just hoping and praying that he lets me know when he has to go out there, and, you know.
It's going to be an interesting day for you.
It's all good. Yeah.
Yeah. That low-level anxiety in the back of your mind, like, is he going to go inside?
It's just white noise. Yeah, like, am I going to have to clean the carpet again?
Listen, I have two small children, and it's a very similar low-level fear that I live with as well. So
you don't know what's going to come out of where.
You don't. Right?
Like, are they going to throw up? Are they going to poop? Pee? It's
anything is possible.
Yeah. It's always spit. Spits everywhere.
Yes.
You know that you say poo and pee, and that is a great segue to the fact that you're from Florida, and so am I.
That is great. Very smooth transition. Makes sense.
Tracks.
Florida. It does, yes.
In one of your stand-up clips that I saw online, you were trying to explain Florida, and it's very confusing trying to explain Florida to people who are not from Florida.
Yeah,
I know you're from Fort Myers, which is a little bit further south. I'm from Orlando originally, so
yeah, it's Central Florida.
Yeah. Now, what is Fort Myers sort of like compared to Orlando? I'm assuming you went to Orlando to go to Disney World at some point when childhood. Yeah.
Yes, for sure. Fort Myers, it's on the Southwest Gulf Coast, and it's kind of boring. I mean, it's, I'd say there's, well, that's not true. There's a retirement community, a large retirement community, but I think that's everywhere in Florida.
Yeah.
And then there's like, you know, sort of your native Floridians, and they're wild. They're pretty wild. There's not much to do sometimes in Florida. So you kind of make your own fun. I did go to college in Miami though. So I would say Miami is different from the rest of Florida. Miami's like being in another country, which I actually had a lot of fun in Miami. But Fort Myers it's Fort Myers. It's growing. It's really growing. But I think it's growing because there's a lot of space.
I have the main question I like to ask other Floridians is how many Confederate flags did you see just in elementary school that you remember?
Oh, enough to think it was normal.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, oh, okay, sweet home Alabama, I guess. Yeah. Just, I was like, roll, tide, roll. Like, what's going on? Just...
I'm seven. I don't know what I'm saying, but is it bad? No.
I was like, this kind of has a little bit of a vibe to it.
Yeah, all that country music mixed in there together. That's why people are like, Beyonce's doing country music. I'm like, anybody from the South, no matter what your background is, we grew up listening to country music, whether we liked it or not. I happen to love country music personally.
I will say, in defense of the North, when I first visited my husband's family in Ohio, I too saw Confederate flags everywhere. So it turns out everyone's an asshole.
Yeah. We have them out here. The first time I saw one out in LA.
Because I've never seen one here.
I mean, it's California. Yeah. Like, you know, when I moved out here, I don't know about you, Fizza, but like when I moved out here, I'm like, you know, everybody's going surfing, surfing USA or like or like, you know, the Valley. And like, and then the first time I saw a Confederate flag, I was like, do they not know the history of this state? I mean, it just seems, but same thing with upstate New York. They have them up there too. Yeah. It's just like, cause it's not about, I mean,
outside of the cities. Outside of the city, there's a lot of country here in California too, and in New York, just a lot of land here in the U.S. and a lot of country folks.
Yeah, the bad. I always call them bad. There's bad rednecks, and then there's good rednecks. There's different kinds of rednecks, you know. Like, there's a Jeff Foxworthy, and then there's like, I don't know, Ted Nugent.
Yeah,
you know who they tend to look like Ted Nugent too. But anyway, but I wonder, you know, you are of Indian American descent. And we know that a lot of Indian American kids, their parents are very strict, you know, about education, about, you know, pursuing the American dream. So how do they feel about you telling jokes about eating ass on stage?
Yes, I need to know.
Curious.
Well, I think they think the concept of eating ass is so outrageous that they're just like, she's just talking shit. So that's fine. That's fine. They don't need the image of me. But also I think, you know, when I'm with them, I'm not talking about that. I'm like, it's
wise.
And also, I'm like very, very grown now, you know, like it's a few decades into it. Yeah. But for the longest time, I just didn't want to perform in front of them.
Yeah.
I mean, even now, if they said they want to come to a show, I'd be like, are you sure? Like, you know, you didn't let me come to your work. So, you know, do you need to sit there to, I mean, the first time my parents came to a show, I was so nervous. And then they sat in the front row, and then my mom laughed at every setup. So she was laughing at the wrong time, just throwing the whole audience off me. It was like, it was too much.
Oh, that's so cute, though. She's trying to like support.
It was cute.
And,
like, that's like adorable.
And it was super cute.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, I think they, I will say that they've been pretty lovely about it. They did make my younger siblings go to med school, I think, because I just was so, it was just like, okay, you both are becoming doctors. And then they are. They're both doctors. Both my younger siblings. And they're probably like, what the hell? They're like, what are you? Why do you think, but you know, I didn't have a lot of ambivalence about what I wanted to do. Like I kind of always knew I wanted to be in entertainment. So they didn't see any opening. Whereas I think with my siblings, maybe they saw an opening like, okay, they're not totally against it. So let's get in here, let's wedge in here and, you know, just pressure them.
Now on that note, at what age did you realize like the concept of stand up? Like how did you, can you remember the exact moment or around the time where you're like, I want to do that when I get older? Like, you know?
Yeah, I was pretty young. I would say maybe I had the thought in middle school, but then I think when I started performing, you know, I would find it was sort of inappropriate sometimes, but like in high school, I would use maybe school presentations or the school news as a platform. And when I saw that I could get a reaction, you know, make people laugh, that sort of became addictive to me at that age. Now I've been 3 years of therapy, so I think what drives me to do stand-up's very different. Before it was just sort of wanting to fill some sort of void, which I think is common with people who go into entertainment. But it was just sort of like doing that, experiencing getting laughter during those early moments, and then also seeing that people made a living doing that. Yeah. So like watching people's specials on TV. I didn't have HBO, but I could listen. I could watch through all, like, I couldn't see Chris Rock doing his special, but I could hear it, you know?
Yes.
Because when you remember, like, back in the day, the TV, like, if you didn't subscribe to the channel, it would be, I don't know if
it,
you know,
it would be like fuzzy on the screen, but you could hear the words. Absolutely, we did that. So, yeah.
So I would listen to comedy specials, like HBO comedy specials that way. And it was, it's just something about it spoke to me.
And so when you went off to college to Miami and got your entire life, because Miami is bonkers and amazing.
Yes.
Did you start doing stand up? How did you sort of professionally get into, like, actually doing it, because you have to physically actually do stand up. It's not as people think it is. It's very, very difficult. So,
yeah. Well, in college, I think I did more. I wouldn't say I started stand up. I've been doing this for about 10 years, but I started in LA.
Okay.
So I may have, I think I did a set here or there in Florida, but like you said, it is really like something where you have to put in the time to progress. And I did that more here. And I think after I got out of college, I went to film school. I didn't really come to terms with like, oh, I can actually do stand up. I thought, again, the pressure from my parents, that would have been too outrageous. I can't go from, you know, like high school to I'm going to do stand up. It was high school to maybe I'll go to law school. Ooh, to I took the LSAT and I was like, fuck this. Then went to the School of Communications, then became a film major, and then thought, okay, I'm going to write and direct. That's respectable enough. And I have family like in India who been in the entertainment industry, so it wasn't outrageous. I mean, it was kind of outrageous, but it wasn't unheard of.
Yeah, because you're a distant relative of Bollywood superstar Mithun Chakraborty. Did I say that right? Did I butcher?
So I did see that. I did see that on IMDb, and that's actually how I learned that.
Oh, wow.
So I don't even know if that's a yeah. But my great uncle, so my grandfather's brother, Abrar Elvi, he has since passed, but he was a renowned screenwriter in Bollywood.
Oh, wow.
Back in the day. Yeah. And I met him maybe once or twice, but I was very close to my grandpa, and they were close too. So that was sort of our connection. But yeah, the other guy, you know, if we are related, I'd love to meet him. I don't know who added that on IMDb, but, you know, thanks for doing the family history, because we have a lot of cousins.
Yeah, and it's like, hook a girl up.
I mean, like whoever added that, if you're listening now, please come out and explain yourself. This is a good moment for that.
So you make your way from Miami. Now, did you come immediately out here to L.A. or did you sort of travel around, or like what was that like when you first got out here to L.A. and started doing your pursuing it professionally?
So I actually went to India for about a month.
Okay. Oh, wow.
After I graduated. Yeah. With my family. And then I moved out to L.A. They always want to do these trips together. And I hadn't been to India since I was 4 or 5, and I haven't been back since. I want to, because there's a huge stand-up scene there and people are into it. I think people come out to shows, but I haven't been back yet. But it's a really cool country.
Yeah.
And stand-up wasn't popping back then there in India. Like, it's like the last sort of 5-10 years that it's really blossomed.
I wonder why. Is it the just, I guess, the internet, or like the exposure to like Netflix International? Is that what it is, maybe?
Yeah, I think everything's just sort of becoming more global. So the platform, there's more exposure to the art form because of these platforms, TikTok, Instagram, YouTube. YouTube's a big one.
Could be Russell Peters.
Yeah, Netflix.
Russell Peters.
Yeah. Well, he was one of the first to, in terms of representation, to be out there. So it was nice to see like the occasional brown face, because it's like, oh my God, okay, there's a chance. Like we can, and now it's gotten a lot better. It's getting a lot better. People are more conscious, I think, about representation.
Yeah. I have a story about Russell. I met him years ago here in LA. Lovely. Let me just start off by saying that. Lovely. And because my friend was visiting from New York and she had worked with him on a show. Because Russell's doing all the black shows. Like, Russell's like, I'm trying to get in wherever I fit in, even though he's from Canada, you know? And so we were like, just like at Runyon. And we like just ran into him. She was like, oh my God. And I didn't know who he was, you know? And so he started talking to us. And this was right before he kind of like really, really blew up. But he was like, he had already had his big time agent, da da da. So he's like, hey, you guys want to go and hang out at my place, right?
What?
And we were like, okay. So he he gets us into his Porsche, right? Because like, so Russell already making money.
Yeah.
We go to his home in the Hollywood Hills. He starts DJing because he's a big DJ. And I was trying to stop him. I was like, you don't know this song. He's like, bet that I got you. He knew every song. He knows all of like all kinds of music. He knows a lot about Black music. And like, I was so impressed. I was like, all right, I'll see you, Russell Peters. I'll see you.
So, Russell can hang.
Yeah. He's fun too. Just it's so delightful to see how big he is because he's a really nice guy. And
he is.
Just amazing.
Do you think you could call him now to be like, hey, like, I'm the Runyon girl. Remember me?
No, I doubt it. He's so big. He's a big, big, big shot. So, you know, but so how has it been since you've been here in LA? Like, do you have any sort of like funny stories of like the beginnings of your stand up doing it regularly? Because you have to do it regularly. And I, full disclosure, I tried stand up twice.
Yeah.
It's terrifying. And I have a long history of like acting study and even sketch and improv. But stand-up is a whole nother beast. Like, I am so impressed.
The first year of doing it, I had to go to the bathroom like 5 times before going on stage. One time I remember I got out of the bathroom, my hands were still wet because I had just washed them. Because, you know, it was just like I couldn't hold anything in because I had just had so many nerves, the fight or flight.
Yeah.
That whole year was just like... just like having to just, I mean, I'll be frank, just poop. Just everything would just come out, you know, like fight or like, it was just like, everything needs to come out. This is because I think that what happens in your brain when you're doing stand-up is very similar. According to a study that I read a long time ago, it's very similar to people when they're skydiving.
Oh, really?
It's just that sort of that level of intensity, adrenaline. Yeah. So there's a lot of like chemical, physiological things going off, and it's intense. It is very, very intense. And I think that's where like, you know, the repetition, doing it over and over again makes it less. So,
yeah.
But,
and how's your creative process? Like, how did you, do you feel like, when was it that you felt like you found your voice? Because every artist has to go through that, especially stand up, like you said, because you're fighting the fight or flight, you know, feeling for, especially when you first started getting up there. But then like, how can you focus and concentrate and be like, oh, that didn't quite work. And this is more of a kind of joke that I would do. Like I always say, the eating the ass, you know, which...
I love that resonated so much.
That's the one. I didn't expect that from you because you look like this proper, beautiful, young woman who's just like, and I was like, oh, we went right there. And you had the same questions I had about it. So,
honestly.
Which is the mark of a wonderful stand up because I can relate because I've had that same question. But at what point did you, like, at what point do you realize, oh, yeah, I'm the girl who makes a joke about eating ass or, you know, a racist matchmaker or, you know, any of that kind of stuff. Like what's like, at what point do you think like 2 years in, you know, a year and a half in, 3 years in, when do you think you sort of got comfortable enough to like, oh, this is okay. I'm in a groove, you know?
I'd say it's cyclical. It's interesting because I'd say like, you know, maybe 5 years, but also since then, like even now, I feel like anytime I'm going through a transition period, I'm still trying to find my voice. Like, what's my voice now? What's my voice today after this many years of therapy or after like, you know, cut to 5 years after that? So, and then, you know, there's like parts of the cycle where I feel really creative and I'm putting stuff out there. And then another part where stuff starts feeling rote and I'm just like, okay, what do I, I'm bored with this. Does it resonate with me? Is my life different? Is this reflecting, you know, what my life looks like now or my feelings about this subject now? So it's always sort of changing and I'll go through periods of like, you know, where I'll feel really good about it. And then periods where I'm a little more, I think, insecure because I'm like, well, am I aligning with my material? So it's really interesting. And I talked to other comics about this and I think it's not uncommon to go through that where you go through periods of creativity and then creative frustration. And I think it's a good thing to evolve. So, you know, it might be scary to sort of leave stuff behind that might have worked in the past, but like, it's sort of always a part of you anyway. It's just like growth.
I think
stand-up in itself is one of the most brave art forms out there, because I think that that's the most true to yourself art. You are on stage sort of vulnerable to everybody. And I just think it's amazing. You also connect with people on things that even they didn't want to admit to, maybe, you know, a little.
I feel attacked. I don't know.
Okay. Well, those are your feelings and I honor them, but
they're valid.
Do you feel like it influences the writing you do, the acting you do? You know, you have a pod, are you still doing your podcast?
We haven't in a while, but we've been thinking about bringing it back.
I think you should.
We have about like 150 episodes.
Okay. Like, do you feel like stand-up is kind of the root of where you go back to do all these other things?
It's sort of, I would say, where I started, because it's what I wanted to do first. And then when you get into the industry as a performer, you sort of have to figure out, okay, well, I have to do other stuff also to make money. Yeah. And I realized, like, acting, I love acting. It's fun. Different skill set. Like, if you did a Venn diagram, there's some overlap.
Definitely.
But also, there's a lot of stuff that's not there. Like, just because you're a good stand-up doesn't mean you know how to act. It's a different skill set. But there are parts of stand-up, like, you know, having comedic timing and that sort of thing that really does help. So, in that sense, yeah, I think, you know, this having a stand-up background helps, because it's also a performance background. It's a public speaking background. Yeah. So I think it does help to come from that background, and it helps with any other sort of performance.
That's How do you like the acting? How do you like the acting?
I love it. It's unionized work, which is fantastic. Stand-up's not unionized, so it's a wild world out there. But acting, like, it's, you know, it's hard to get into it, get in the work. I remember, like, when I first got into the union, I think 9 years ago, I don't know exactly, but like, I remember that was a big deal. Cause I remember being at that point in my career of like, you know, that would be such a big deal. Can I get into the union? Now it's like, oh, well, I want to get this level of a role or this. So it's interesting to sort of like, is climbing each rung of the ladder. Cause it's not easy. Like, I had to, just because I, you know, was able to do stand up didn't mean I would say I had to learn how to act.
Yeah.
Like, it really is, you know, I had to put in the work. It wasn't just something I was like, oh, I know how to do this.
Yeah. It's a different skill set. And, you know, I've often been curious about this because, you know, Miriam knows her experience as an actor, being a Jewish woman. Like, we've had conversations about, I hadn't even thought about it, I think, until it was Sarah Silverman many years ago was saying how, like, you never see leading ladies who are clocked as Jewish. And I was like, I had never even thought about that. You know, certainly, you know, as a Black actress or actor, you understand, like, you know, I used to joke when I first started acting, like, they either want Black women to be crack whores or judge. Like, there's no in between, you know, unless you're Gabrielle Union or somebody like that. But like, it's changed and it's gotten better in the industry, but the industry is still very tough. What is it like for an Indian American actress who looks Indian American? Like, what are some of the like challenges and, like, you know, sort of stereotypes that you are trying to desperately avoid? Or have you even had that experience, you know, of late? Like, what is that like for you?
Well, I'd say I've been doing this for about a decade, so I've seen a shift in the industry for sure. Okay. You know, I was getting more stereotypical roles early on. I did a diversity showcase with one of the studios where they just really wanted me to always have an Indian accent, you know, just really try to pigeon me into certain types of roles. And I think now that people are more, you know, quote unquote woke, they're trying to at least say that, you know, on all the breakdowns of casting that, you know, this role is, we're open to all types and, you know, all types of diversity, meaning like, you know, people with different abilities, physically, ethnically diverse, even gender diversity. But still, you know, it's there. So there's more, we're getting considered more. We're getting considered for like, you know, like the standard roles, because we were considered kind of niche. Like you play this character or this. Not, you can't just be like a normal person or like a leading. You can't have your own story. Like you're not three dimensional. So now we're getting more dimension. And our stories, I think you're seeing more and more of that out there. But yeah, a lot of the big projects, you know, they take into consideration the market. And because I think of, I mean, human history, there's colorism, you know, like the algorithm, some, like, even if you go down to like, you know, social media, sometimes the algorithm prefers, or people respond more to like a pretty, like conventionally, you know, conventional AKA standard.
White.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So they're, you know, I think they're trying to sort of, no one wants to get sued now that we're all talking about this.
Yeah, like it's like, and that's why when people are like, oh, we're anti-woke, and it's like, so you're anti, like they're basically anti-inclusion.
Yeah.
And yeah. You know, is that the reason that led to you creating the sort of the collective multifacial?
Like, oh yeah, facial recognition comedy.
I'm sorry, multifacial.
Yeah,
you know,
no,
you know where I got that from? Long time ago, Vin Diesel, he would be considered black in the United States. I get it, he's biracial, but he would consider be black. But he did a short that got him some attention called Multifacial, about how his experience, because he's so pale. So they were like, you're not black enough, da da da. And that's one of the reasons that he decided, I think, to just sort of go ambiguous. But black people be looking at him like, man, we know a Negro when we see one, but whatever. But facial recognition comedy, which I think is such a great idea. Do you want to tell the audience about that? I just love how you just took the bull by the horns and you're like, we're going to create something, you know, for me and people like me in the industry.
And I love how the title is you calling it out. You're just calling it out. Facial. I love it.
And I love the tagline. No, we're not the same woman.
Yes. Yeah.
I love it. But can you tell the audience a little bit more about it?
Yeah, for sure. So facial recognition comedy, it started initially as a meme. So I got tired of everyone confusing the handful of us at the time with each other. You know, he would have full conversations with someone and they would just end the conversation with saying bye, whoever else's name. And it's like, they thought I was talking to a whole other, like we would get confused. Someone brought me up on stage as my friend Zara, who also does comedy. Like, it was hilarious.
Wow.
So this was commonplace, actually. Like, or if one of us got a job, someone else would get congratulated. So then it's like, well, we pass on the message because like someone thought it was you. Good job on this thing from them. But I made this facial recognition guide with our faces, and it said something like, you know, if you encounter any South Asian woman comic, and, you know, refer to this before assuming you know who you're talking to. And then also at the time, you know, when you looked at lineups of shows, there wasn't much diversity, and maybe there'd be one token person. There definitely wasn't two of us on a lineup because, you know, and so that's where the idea of we are not the same person came in, because like, yeah, we are, you know, have the same ethnic background, but the perspective might not, we're different people. We are different people. So then I made the image of our faces in the sense we are not the same person on our foreheads. And I love it. I decided, like, you know, if they won't put more than one of us on a show, so I'll put all of us on a show.
That's right.
That's how that started.
Yeah. Yes, we love that. And that is why you're a notorious woman.
Yes.
Because notorious women, and obviously you're heroic, notorious woman, they don't give a fuck. All right. Mm. They're like, listen, yeah. let's take the bull by the horns. And I just love that. Now, how has that informed, like, the kinds of roles you take, how you navigate the industry? Do you feel like it's, because it takes a while for the industry, and like you said, I feel like a lot of these initiatives are begrudgingly done because people don't want to be sued, they want to be seen like doing the right thing, because I feel like we'd have a lot more progress in the industry to really reflect what America looks like.
It is half a step forward, but it's only half a step. Like, I remember the breakdowns. Do you guys remember? I want a woman 5'7" who weighs 102 pounds and has medium length blonde-ish hair. Like, it was, I mean, it was almost comical. You're like, okay, so this is better, but it's only like half a step better, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of progress that we could be making. I see a lot of things where, but I guess it's, you know, one step at a time, I suppose. Yeah. Or half a step. You have to take half a step before you can take a full step, right?
Listen, there used to be a time in early Hollywood where Asian Americans who were East Asian would play Native American people.
Yes.
Probably play South Asian people with brown face on, right?
Yeah.
They could play all those roles, except they could not play leads because those roles had to go to white people in yellow face or red face or what have you. But, and, you know, we're basically all still fighting those stereotypes that were set out. And, you know, it's called the Hays Code, basically, where they just set up, like, you know, black people had to be in subservient roles. That is part of the Hays Code. And no non-white actors could kiss or be in any romantic, which is why it's just weird. Like, when you watch like old films, you just have to watch them anyway. But when you watch, like, you know, I'm a big mystery person. So when you watch, you know, Charlie Chan mysteries, it's just like, dude, are you fucking kidding me? Like, so the actor who plays the son, the actor who plays the secretary could be Asian American, but Charlie Chan himself has to be a white man with a terrible Asian accent.
Mm-mm. It's not just, okay.
It's so cringeworthy. And they were just like, yeah, that's fine. I recently watched I'm a big, you know, Bette Davis fan. That's no surprise. Yeah. A lot of people are. But I recently watched a film called The Letter, and it's like part of the Criterion. And I was like, oh, this is really good. You know, she's a strong woman. And then this character comes in, and I forget the actress's name. She's clearly supposed to be like Indonesian. But the extras who are also supposed to be Indonesian are clearly East Asian American, but they're like, oh, same difference, right? But she comes in and the lady has on, not only would they do yellow face, but they would like change the eyes with tape. And I'm just really? It's like,
instead of anything to not hire a brown person.
Exactly.
Anything. Isn't that wild?
Yep. We're still fighting that. And we're also
like,
all
we're
fighting.
Using tape.
They're using tape.
You could save money on tape, you guys. You could save your budget.
No, but then that means the white person would not be the lead. But,
oh, no.
But it's so crazy to me because basically what we're all fighting are those stereotypes and those standards, those Hollywood standards that were set out so long ago that they're fighting against. That's when they're like normal. You're like, that wasn't even normal. Like,
I know,
we're
right?
All fighting. That's not normal. It's not normal. So, but you're right. It is better. It's definitely better. Because when I talked to, we recently had an interview with Denise Nicholas, who was working mainly in the 60s, 70s and 80s and 90s. But she's of that era. And she's a lighter skinned black woman. So well before Halle Berry. And there were lighter skinned actresses before her that had to fight that struggle. But she got frustrated because they told her basically they didn't really know what to do with her. They're like, Well, are you really black? Because it's their version of black is a specific kind of black person. Mm-hmm. So she's fighting against that. But she's like, I am literally a black person. Like, so what do you mean?
Yeah.
You know, and just and then let's not even get into ageism and all that other stuff that a lot of the white actresses have to fight when they get over 30, you know, or start to look over 30. So, but it's just so interesting. I love that you carved out. But I just thought that when I went to the website, it was like, we are not the same woman. I cackled because it's like, it's like, it's finding, and that's why you're so brilliant as a comedian and a comedy performer. Like, you have to find the funny in something that's terrible, because at the root of it, you're like, what? They literally think we're the same person?
Yeah, it definitely stemmed from frustration. You know, like, I think a lot of good material stems from a lot of feeling. Like, you feel strongly about it. You have a strong point of view. There's a lot of energy behind it, a lot of sentiment or whatever. So I think, you know, at the time, it did come from frustration, because it's like, yeah, it's like feeling, you know, it's funny from one perspective, but from another perspective, it makes you feel subhuman.
Right.
And that's grating when it happens over and over and over. So that this was sort of a response to that.
What I love did is you took control of the narrative, is that you didn't let them beat you down. You actually took control and you made fun of them. You made them feel bad. And I love that. That makes you notorious. Like, that is exactly what we all need to be doing. And that's amazing.
Yeah. Who are you? I'm curious to know, who are some of your comedy heroes? Like, so who are some of the people that you, you mentioned Chris Rock earlier, but like, who are some of your major influences, like, you know, and what you do and inspire you every day?
Gosh, I love Wanda Sykes.
Yes.
I think she's brilliant. I grew up watching Sarah Silverman, so it's incredible, like, how she's just has had such a long career. Yeah. I mean, I watched her as a kid, and now, you know, I did a show with her the last year, and I was like, oh, it's pretty nice. Or even meeting like Russell Peters. I've done a show with Russell. He hosted facial recognition comedy once.
That's good. Cool. Looking at Russell. Yeah.
But that's, you know, stuff like that. It's just, because also I think fame back then was different. Like, when people were famous, like, they were really, really famous, because there weren't as many famous people back then. So it's just, you know, it is sort of surreal. Margaret Cho, seeing her, you know, I remember seeing her on TV and talking about, you know, her culture and stuff. Like, that was so different. That was inspiring, because it's like, oh, well, there is room, you know, there's a chance for another perspective here. But then there is also the concept of, like, there could only be one. So it's just like that would, and that's the tokenism aspect of it. But I always try, when people ask that, I always try to mention the women, because women get WNBA'd. You know, everyone wants to watch the NBA, but no one really talks at the WNBA, regardless of just how great some of the players are. So it's similar in comedy, I think. But
that's great. I love what you just said, WNBA'd. And you're right.
Yeah. I'm gonna take that. I will give you credit every time I say it. I'm running with it.
I don't even know if it's, I think it's between me and my roommate. She's a comedian as well. Jill Chrissy, very funny woman, black woman. Look her up. I'll send you her info.
Send us her info. Yes. I'll give you both credit. Yeah, that's fine. WNBA'd. Yes. Yes. I mean, that's literally what we try to do here. Like, that's why we started to do what we did, because we just feel like people aren't, it's the second thought. Women are the second thought, and there's no reason for it. I mean, there's no good reason for it. There's obviously a reason, but it's a bad reason.
Yeah.
Patriarchy sucks. That's what I'm saying. Thanks. I'll clarify.
Yes.
Yeah.
It does.
And I love what you said about mentioning the women always, because yeah. sometimes, and I get disappointed, and I get, especially the older women who've been in the industry and laid the groundwork, sometimes you'll hear them say, well, I'm not a woman comic, or I'm not a woman, yeah. you know, I'm not an actress, I'm an actor. And it's like, I know what you're saying, or I'm not a woman director. It's like, I know what you're saying, but what's wrong with being a woman director or yeah. woman comic, or like, what's wrong with that? Like, there's nothing wrong with that. Like, it's, you know, it's
to the society level, it's like putting the W in front of the NBA.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah, it makes it less than. Like, we gotta exactly. womanize it up, you know. So, and it's,
we gotta,
like,
own it. We gotta be like, yes, I am mm-hmm. a woman director. It's like, yeah. yeah, it's owning, taking ownership of that. And I guess I understand why you don't want to, you know, you want to be seen as equal, not less than, but
No,
we can Fizza, still own.
I don't want to be considered equal. I want to be considered better than men. Okay.
Better than. Let's take that. Let's take that and
yeah,
run.
Why not? Why not? Isn't it our turn?
This is like
a little, like, right?
Yeah. We all know little boys and little girls when they're growing up, you're like, that, the boys usually are special. I know people say that that's not politically correct, but you're like, he needs to. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he might get into community college. We'll be happy. Most of the boys, if we do that. And the girls just are like far above, like beyond, you know. Yeah. So it's like, I remember, I think it was around like 11 or 12 when someone was like, you can't do that because you're a girl. And I was like, yeah. so confused. I was like, but girls are better at it than boys. What are you talking about?
I played the saxophone in junior high and high school. And I remember being like, I want to play, you know, it was like the band program. What do you want to play? I want to play the alto saxophone. Okay, cool. And so, you know, my parents didn't blink. They were like, let's go again. And I got so much, but you're a girl. And I could not figure out a musical instrument is like male or female. I don't understand it. And that was probably one of the first moments for me where I realized, like, wow, everything I do, it will be defined by the fact that I'm female, because this feels like it has nothing to do with anything, but it's really,
yeah.
All right. So I'm a girl saxophone player. Okay. Also, yep. I just want to point out right now on this podcast that I was better than all the boys. Thank you.
Of course you were.
Thank you.
Because better than, see?
Better than, like, and even in the queer space, a lot of queer friends and family and loved ones will say, like, femme qualities are considered less than mass qualities. True. And it's just like, it's, yeah. And it's, I don't know. It's, but that always seemed absurd to me. I was just like, I mean, we all know, like, masculine qualities are a little slow. I just, you know, just
some people can't handle the truth.
They can't handle the truth.
Facts.
Some people.
Exactly. But
you
now
have to soften it up. Kid gloves. Put on the kid right. gloves.
Kid gloves
with,
and tiny violins. Yes,
so
all of
many
that.
Tiny violins.
So many. I just, you know, now, so you are doing a lot more acting. At Lincoln Lawyer, I saw that recently because, of course, we stalked you in trying to do our research. So what is your dream life, career life? Like, what is it that you'd like to do? What is it that do you want to be known as, like, a Wanda Sykes, like that kind of career trajectory? Like,
I mean, what an honor.
I know, right?
If she's, you want us to refer to you as she's like Wanda Sykes, I'm happy to do that.
Oh, I mean, that would, I'd be happy with that. But, you know, if I could just say anything, I just want to carve my own lane out and be able to make a living doing this. I think it is so hard to make a living in entertainment. So I want to do everything that I have the capacity to do, you know, TV, movies, stand up, specials, live performances. It's, yeah, I don't really have a limit. I think I just want to sort of see what can I do. And then also, it's just like, there could be stuff I want to do that I haven't even conceived of yet. So
yeah,
that's,
you know,
true.
Technology is changing, culture's changing, everything. So yeah, I think I'd want to just be able to have a long career. I think that, you know, what that looks like specifically, like, I don't know, as of right now, like a TV job would be fantastic. You know, yeah. I'll take a recurring role any day, unless I have to do an accent.
Right.
I know.
And I'll be like, let's make this a one-off. But yeah, I think just, you know, when you see these entertainers, they've diversified. You see them acting, you see them performing stand-up. If people have the capacity to sing, ability, the gift to sing, which I don't necessarily.
I don't either. It's okay.
You know, they could.
I still do it anyways, but it's not pretty.
Singing.
Yeah, right? We should go to karaoke together. I love singing.
I do for me. Yes.
Yes.
I love karaoke. I love singing, but yeah, it's literally just for me because it'd be cruel and unusual to subject
absolutely
unwilling ears to it.
Yeah. We could drag Lovetta though. She could suck it up. It'll be fine.
We'll cut to Fizza on 10th season? 10th season of The Masked Singer.
Yes.
Maybe. I'll do it.
You never know. You know, one thing in your bio that I wanted to ask you about specifically, the Clubhouse Creator First contest that you won. What was that like? Like, in how... I was on Clubhouse a lot when it first sort of came out, but I haven't been on in a while.
It's kind of, honestly, I haven't been on Clubhouse in a while. I think like there was a moment in the pandemic where it was huge.
Yes.
Everyone was on it.
Yeah.
And we weren't able to see people. We weren't able to do live performances. So here is this brand new, exciting platform. And they were trying to like find creative, new, different ways to bring people to the platform in terms of content. So it was exciting at the time because we were stuck inside, but I'd say, you know, stand up is in person. It's just a different experience. And when people started using that platform less, then it wasn't, you know, like people preferred just sort of, I don't know, like it didn't last. I think the platform kind of fizzled out. It's still around. I haven't used it, but I remember for that period of time, it was very exciting. It was very exciting because it was like, oh my God, we can perform. We can perform wearing pajamas. I mean, I'd wear pajamas in public, but like pajamas in my house. I'm wearing, you know, like this was being shot from the waist up. So I have pajamas on in the waist down always. If I'm at home and you can only see the waist up, just assume I'm wearing pajamas always.
Same.
Yeah.
Same. You know, also I was thinking about this because we know that white supremacy is global. And I know that, just sort of change topics a little bit. Like I've often been curious about, I know how colorism works in the Black community. And I've only heard a little bit about how it works in, the East Asian or, South Asian communities. Do you find any of that filtering in your experience in Hollywood when you go out for roles? Like are, you know, the casting directors and directors even aware of that in within the South Asian community?
You know, I can't speak for the casting directors, but there absolutely is colorism in the community. And it's so deeply engraved where, you know, I have friends who are like, you know, modern women and they try to, you know, it bothers them if they appear darker in photos. And it's because it's been so ingrained. I think if, you know, lighter skin does give you more privilege, looking more white does give you more privilege. That's why you see a lot of sort of like ethnically ambiguous people are like, you know, when they cast a lead, it'll be, I think, you know, I have a pretty, like, even though I'm very much like Indian, like I don't look white, I do have a lighter complexion. And I think that has definitely is a privilege and an advantage. And I think also, you know, like the algorithm responds to that differently than it does to darker faces, unfortunately. Yeah. So, you know, I don't know whether they're conscious about it because a lot of people in casting are not.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Like, I think most are not.
Yeah.
I don't even know if I know an Indian casting director.
And I was thinking honestly. Because I coming up, I had a lot of Indian, South Asian friends, and you know, especially in high school and college, because Florida being Florida, it's surprising, a melting pot. So, and that's when I even first was even introduced to the idea of colorism within the Asian, South Asian communities. And then I remember when Mindy Kaling became really, really big, and also with The Voice, because Mindy has a very unique voice as well. But I was struck by how dark she is, you know, and we know that some Indian people are as dark as people consider Black people, right? So, but I remember thinking, being so excited that she was in such a high platform, because I was like, you know, until white people or other Black people, they don't know what a big deal it was. And I was like, no, the fact that she's like really dark and has her own TV show and it comes into people's homes and now, you know, globally is a really, really big deal. And I just don't think that people were really aware of that. I still don't think so, because she's still, I feel like when people think of, well, actually, because of her success, maybe people do include darker skin Indian people, but I don't even know if it clocks sometimes. And then I notice also in the advertising for her stuff, she appears to be a little bit lighter. And that could be lighting, too, because I'm a dark-skinned Black woman, but sometimes in photos, I look lighter. And it's just my undertone. And so when the flash goes off, it picks up the yellow in my undertone. And so some people are like, are you bleaching? I'm like, oh, hell no. Bleaching, just so you know, bleaching with Black Americans went out in the 60s. I'm Black and I'm proud. It's like, it doesn't mean it doesn't go on, but Black people, it's a big problem in the Caribbean and on the continent of Africa, which is shocking to African Americans, because we're like, we thought you guys knew better. Like, you know what I mean? But it's like you said, like, colonialism and colorism is a part of that. It's so deeply ingrained in, you know, these colonized societies that people don't even think it's a thing. Like, they just talk about it, and we're horrified in our modern sensibilities sometimes. But, you know, obviously growing up, and it's really big. It was still big in the South with Black people, and it's still big in the Black community. And then people get defensive about it. And I'm like, we literally in America used to have a brown paper bag test. So I don't know why people are like, Black people are like, it doesn't. I'm like, we literally had a brown paper bag test, like, and it's just unofficial now, you know, in a lot of ways. But I was very curious about your experience, because I think of we have a lot more high profile, you know, Indian American and even Indian talent, more mainstream. And I was just wondering, because it does seem like it's still lighter skin, Indian and Indian American talent. And I just, even though Mindy Kaling is extremely successful.
I think she's the exception, not the rule. And lighter skin is just more palatable more marketable, or seen as more marketable to our audiences that have been, you know, influenced by colonialism.
I mean, I was,
you know, unconsciously.
That I think about every place you talked about, Lavetta. That's all colonialism, and that, you know, kind of destroyed the world, and we're trying to bring it back, basically.
You know? Which, again, as a Black American person whose family been here since the 1700s, when I see white people are like, I want a tan. I mean, as dark as you, that I want to get braids. I'm like, you can suck it. Okay. Like, so it's just like, us is like, it's a, like, you guys demonize, like, dark skin, big lips, big asses. And then all of a sudden, y'all all want it. But y'all don't want to be Black. Y'all don't want to be dark. Like, naturally. But it's like, I spent all this money for tanning. I spent all this money for butt injections. You know? And also what annoys me, just as a Black person, like, because it's Black History Month. Like, it's just like this sort of like Brazilian butt lift. I mean, you mean a Black butt lift? Or like, you know, in, I remember watching Oprah when I was a kid, and the guy came on, this white surgeon came on, he's like, yeah, we call the fuller lips the Paris lip. And she's like, you mean the Negro lip?
Yes, Oprah.
And it's just like,
girl.
But it's just, it's so funny, because I'm like, you guys are saying you don't like this stuff, but we know secretly y'all actually do. But in these marginalized and colonized societies, no, they don't. They actually want, you know, the thinner lips and the paler skin, and, you know, they find that more desirable. I personally don't. I just, because I like big lips, but that's a whole thing.
That's for your dating site.
Right here.
Yeah.
That's but you do have to be conscious of it, I feel like, and especially in American, because America is, you know, Hollywood is default. It's still blonde hair and blue eyes. Like, you know, my white female actor friends are like, yeah, I mean, ain't that many blondes in America. We all know, we know a bottle blonde when we see one, right? Like, you say that,
it's a recessive gene.
Yeah, exactly.
There you go. It's science.
It's like... It always, I used to tease everybody. I'm like, now listen, I grew up in, because you grew up in Florida. There's a lot of blondes around. And it's like, not all y'all look like ScarJo. I don't know why y'all acted like blonde women all look like Charlize Theron or Margot Robbie. No. They do not. Okay. So it's just, but it's still in the culture when people say all American. What do they mean?
Blonde.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what they mean.
Even though, you know, I think, well, I was going to say the people who were in America before the blondes weren't blonde.
No, they were not.
Nope.
So all American.
Yeah. It's like something we're fighting. And it's just, you know, we do have to keep up the fight by creating our own spaces that like you've done. We're so impressed with how, like, just not only how talented and beautiful and charismatic you are, but, you know, you're really doing the work. And this is the hard part, you know, the hard part behind the scenes. Like, okay, you know, the industry, it's better than it was even 10, 15 years ago, but it's still challenging. So what can I do to create and carve out a space for myself? And we're just so impressed with, like, how you operate and navigate the industry and, you know, keep up the good fight. And also creating a space for other actresses such as yourself, you know, and other performers. Yeah. Because there's power in numbers. Like, I've never understood the whole token mentality. There could only be one, like the Highlander, I guess, you know?
Well, it's the benefit of white supremacy.
Yep.
The tokenism. Yeah. That's, you know, that's just, we can have one because that we can, you know, that's easy to manage and control. Mm-hmm. But
exactly. But,
yeah. When there's a whole bunch of us, like you said, power in numbers.
Yeah. And it's like, I always tease my friends. I'm like, you know, I'd be like, you know, white people don't know how to share. We just want to share. Like, white people just want to share. We just want, like, in the cast. We wanted to reflect America. Like, that's the strength of America, right? Like, that's the strength of, like, you know, my childhood was so rich because I knew different kinds of people. So when I leave and go out into the world and I'm talking to someone and I'm like, oh, do you speak Urdu? And they're like, how do you know that? And I'm like, oh, because I have friends. I have, like, you know what I mean? It's like, I know the difference between a Sikh and a Muslim. Like, I know the difference.
Which is amazing. Which is amazing. I don't know that it should be amazing, but it is amazing.
It shouldn't
be. Oh, my God, you do. Like, that's incredible. Like you said, Urdu. I'm like, oh my God, you know what Urdu is?
Yes.
Like,
and people feel seen when you mention a part of their culture that alive. People are like, oh my God, you know that? Like, I remember there's actually Zainab, who's a big stand up comic now.
I know Zainab.
And I remember Zainab saying that in one of her stand up specials, she was saying that because she's Muslim and she's like, Arab people get so excited. They're like, your name is Zainab? My sister's name is Zainab. And then, like, and it makes people feel seen. Like, they're not an outlier. There's something wrong with them. But that's also American culture, you know, that the melting pot. This is what makes it's a strength. I don't know why so many in our, well, we know why, white supremacy. But it's like, no, America is strengthened by the different kinds of people. We have amazing food in America.
And that's why. Yeah. That is why. Let me tell you, delicious. My family just ordered very delicious Indian food the other night. Let me tell you how sad we would be if every time we ordered food, it was a hamburger. I'm just saying, we need diversity. I can't eat too many hamburgers.
Or just an apple pie, even though apple pie is pretty delicious. Yeah. But you know.
It's funny, you had Indian food last night. I actually had a hot dog.
Okay.
Exactly right. See, that's America.
That's America.
It's like the option I can have a hot dog and you can have Indian food is amazing. Like, that is incredible.
Yeah, Mexican food. I didn't like Mexican food before I moved to LA. Well, and I was like, oh, because I've been having terrible Mexican food. Now I have the good stuff.
That's what happens.
Like, this is the good stuff. Yeah.
The good
stuff. You guys are making me hungry.
I know, now I'm kind of hungry.
I know.
I'm starving. I'm like, oh, that all sounds so good.
I know. Well, we won't keep you. Fizza Dosani, this is amazing. This has been amazing. Please correct me if I did not say your name correctly.
Perfectly.
Okay, sweet. Good. Because we want people to know where they can find you. Actually, where can they find you? What do you have coming up? Do you want to plug anything? You know.
Yeah, I'd love to plug stuff. So you can find me online. That's probably the easiest way to find me. Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, at Fizza Dosani, FizzaDosani. Even if you spell it wrong, maybe it'll come up. And then
I understand. I do understand that. Yes.
Yeah. And then I have a monthly show at the Comedy Store, Facial Recognition Comedy. We do take it on tour, but right now we have it monthly at the Comedy Store. I believe the next one's March 19th, 8 p.m. in the Belly Room. Tickets and information's on my website, fizzadosani.com. Oh, actually, you know what? Forget that. Go to my Instagram,
okay.
Fizzadosani. I'll put all the information and stuff on there.
Yes.
All right.
This has been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time out to come and talk with us and, you know, humor us with our terrible questions and terrible, at least me, I'm speaking for myself, terrible humor, because you're a professional. So, you know.
Well, Libetta, Miriam, thank you so much for having me. And I would say all the questions were great and you both have very good humor and I had fun and a lot of laughs. So I'm,
yay.
You know, anytime someone can make me laugh, I'm happy because it does feel good.
Oh, we'd love to hear that.
Sometimes as a comic, you know, like we see sets, we get kind of like, you know, hardened. Like I joke around like a comedian's way of laughing is just saying, oh, that's hilarious. Just so you know, because you're around it so much. If we were to respond appropriately to all the we would, like, our face would hurt. Like you just wouldn't have any juice left. So it's just like, yeah, it's funny. but this has been a delight.
Oh, thank you. We appreciate that. Oh, well, on that note, before I get all emotional. So on that note, we are going to wrap it up for this latest episode of Notorious Women Podcast. Guys, remember to follow us on all the things. Also, copy and send the link to your friend. Just don't tell them about this wonderful podcast where they can hear Fizza. Just copy the link and send it to your friends, okay? And also remember to subscribe and like on YouTube and on all the platforms. And you can also support the show at patreon.com. That's patreon.com/notoriouswomen. And Miriam, where else can they find and support the show?
You guys, we're also on Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube. All three are Notorious Women Podcast. So just Notorious Women Podcast. You'll find us on all those things. You can DM us at Instagram. You can also email us at notoriouswmpod@gmail.com. And that is that.
Oh, and also, because our producers are going to kill us, we have a website now.
We do have a website now.
Yep. NotoriousWomenPodcast.com.
You guys.
So you can check us out there.
Yes.
Again, Fizza, thank you so much for joining us. And you have a wonderful day. And you guys support Fizza at all her things. Fizza Dosani at all the things. Okay? Do it. Do it now. All right, guys. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Produced by Atavita Studios. Connect your voice to the world.